May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom all and welcome. I am your host, Ariel Bartzadok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. Here again is the official opening for this class. I've entitled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desires in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I'm not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I'm not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I am sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I am here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of a historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of God. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who, like him, were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and maasim tovim. Yeshu was not a Christian, neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah-observant Jews, as was he. As Jews educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as an Torah Orthodox rabbi to read them, understand them, as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author, and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept the Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. I have been led to perform this work because of the experiences of my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by a very evil, lying, deceptive individual who turned out also to be a pedophile. I am thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I had fought long and hard against this group and am proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity and have therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever of the truth that is still out there to be discovered. And now after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I am here to explain to you, to them, and all willing to listen, what we Torah-faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson. Alrighty, you know that's our traditional introduction to this class. Always got to say that, disclaimer, so as, you know, never to be accused, God forbid, of wrong things. Well, in this class, we are going to begin to actually look at those teachings ascribed to Yeshu directly, the famous Sermon of the Mount. Now, I've read through this stuff, and I said, okay. I mean, nothing really stood out to me so overwhelmingly profound. But I wanted to do research. I wanted to see, haven't there been others throughout the many centuries who have actually looked at this material from a Jewish point of view. And needless to say, I did not come up empty. There are numerous sources. I have a number of books and things that I was looking for, doing my homework. And the one that I found, that I actually found most striking, was a book written by a Rabbi Gerald Friedlander. And it's called The Jewish Sources of the Sermon on the Mount. It was originally published in London in 1911. He was the minister of the Western Synagogue in London. Now, in order to approach this subject of Yeshu's teachings, famously in Christianity called the Sermon on the Mount, I want to put it within a context of significance of, well, I don't like to have to do this, but in order to introduce what I want to read from him, I have to do this. We've got to put Judaism and Christianity here on a seesaw, because the one thing that I think is so adamant that needs to be addressed and has never been addressed is the matter of religious racism or chauvinism, if you will. Since its inceptions, Christianity has been the scourge of Judaism. It has always claimed to be the replacement of Judaism, and therefore that Judaism is wrong, and Christianity, of course, being better. And needless to say, this has led to countless centuries of Christian animosity and hatred towards Jews, especially towards Judaism. And the history of violence from the church is well documented. We don't have to go there. This is something that has never really been fully addressed. And unless it is addressed, now, when I say addressed, I don't mean to ask for an apology. We are sorry. I mean, you know, talk is cheap over the graves of millions of people. I'm talking about addressing fundamental issues of doctrine and theology, wherein which you say, we believe this is the way of God, and God says, etc., and so on. Now, to put this into a context, I want to read to you something to help us introduce the Sermon on the Mount. And I want to read to you from Rabbi Friedlander's book again, and explain where this, if you will, necessity comes from, trying to understand why it's important to take the approach that I am. You see, I believe, after reviewing the Sermon on the Mount, that it's pretty much Jewish teachings. I was really surprised, and I was scratching my head. I mean, is there really anything overtly Christian here? And I was surprised to find what I did. But let me read what I'm saying before I comment further. I'm going to read to you from Rabbi Friedlander's book, Source of the Sermon on the Mount, section on Beatitudes, page 12 and 13, and I quote, "Christian scholars and apologists are naturally concerned to demonstrate the superiority of Christian teaching. They claim that the last word in religion and ethics has been taught by Jesus. They invite Jews and others to learn the, in quote, higher morality revealed in the New Testament. It's almost impossible in a modern Christian country such as England for the Jew to refuse to listen to these pressing invitations. We are today confronted by honest and well-meaning men who ask us to be candid and to acknowledge that the moral teaching of Jesus is higher and better than that of any other teacher. Can we afford to imitate the old Jewish attitude, which is quite right in the dark days of persecution? And shall we still refuse to read the Gospels or discuss their contents? If we do, we shall not act in harmony with the old teachings of the rabbis who said, know how to answer the opponent. Or if you remember the original Hebrew, Dala Shivla Epikoros, Pirkei Avot, getting back to the text, whose claim to possess a better religion should be met by a fearless justification of Judaism as the purest of all forms of religion. To remain Jews and to refuse to defend the Jewish religion or willfully to ignore the claims made by Christian teachers when asserting the absolute superiority of their religion is a cowardly and irreligious attitude. Two famous German Christian theologians have published within the last few years two books which have been epoch-making. We refer to Dr. Harnack's What is Christianity? And to Dr. Bosset's learned work on the Jewish religion entitled Der Religion des Juden, something in German, which I can't read. Both books are alike in claiming that Christianity teaches religion and morality from a higher standpoint than that taught by Judaism. The German Jewish scholars were not silent. Rabbis Perls, Gudeman, Eschelbacher, and Bach, among others, took up the challenge, and again as of old, vindicated the Jewish religion. This, we claim, is the bounded duty of English Jewish scholars. We must know how to answer our opponents and how to defend the religion of Israel. We shall not only show that we appreciate our own religion, but we shall at the same time discover how much Jews and Christians have in common. You see, the big problem here, end of quote, the big problem, and I've discovered this over many years, is that Christians, for the most part, indeed the sincere good people that they are or can be today, really have absolutely no idea of Jewish teachings. So when they read some of the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, which are pretty cool, they say, wow, that's so beautiful, that's so sublime, that's so great. As a Jew, we might nod our head and say, yeah, okay. To which then the Christian says, well, how come then you don't follow Yeshu? Look at these beautiful teachings. You see, the follow-up line is, yeah, well, we recognize Yeshu's teachings because we know where they came from. You see, my dear Christian neighbor, you don't know the rabbis of the Talmud. You don't know Rabbi Hillel. You don't know Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. You don't know Rabbi Eliezer. You don't know Yeshu's contemporaries and those who came before him who taught these things who Yeshu was quoting. To which a usual evangelical response, well, they came later and Yeshu's teachings were first and maybe the rabbis took from Yeshu. Well, you want to know something? I'll answer you again. Rabbi Friedlander's book is a good source. He quotes here one of the old church fathers on page 16 of his book here. He says, according to Tertullian, one of the old church fathers, the Sermon of the Mount was believed to have been in agreement with the spirit and teaching of the Hebrew Scriptures. And he quotes an old book here, the Advent of Marcion, chapter 4:14, verses from the Old Testament to illustrate, to explain the sermon. And he clearly indicates that it contains nothing new. It seems to him that it's really a condensed summary of the Old Testament teachings. Well, there you go. It was known even in ancient times, at the times when these things were originally read, of their Judaic context. And this has been lost today because of the prejudice and the racism which creates such a chasm between the communities that no one ever bothers to seek to build a bridge. They try to build bridges politically through Christian Zionism, but no one wants to address the real issues of the religion itself. And I think that if more Christians were to study more Judaism, the more that they would be able to appreciate the Judaic teachings. And of course, that's the purpose of this class. I remember once, many years ago, I was approached by some young evangelicals who asked me a very simple question. Rabbi, do you Jews believe in or even know of the Ten Commandments? Now, you might chuckle. You might think that's a ridiculous question. But in the likes of how they were raised, they had no idea and concept that the Ten Commandments are part of a Torah that the Jews know. They really did not know. Now, to answer with scorn is, of course, not the way to properly respond. but to try to educate and teach. Our job is to build bridges. Like the wise words in Pirkei Avot, Da Lashiv, know how to properly respond. My critique to my rabbinic peers is that they often enter into polemic debate, war, to try to fight, to try to prove the Christian wrong, rather than try to help them understand the things that they themselves might not. And we've discussed this in our previous lessons. Does Isaiah 7:14 really speak of a virgin birth? Well, interpret it any way you want. Who cares? But the Christian should never be so pedantic to say, well, it refers to Yeshua and no one else. Well, that's not so. That's not being honest. You want to believe it refers to Yeshua? Go ahead. But now, I've set my foundation. I put things in the context. We got a lot of work here to cover. And the first section of the teachings here, well, let's just review one small thing here. Was this an actual historical event? Chapter 5 in Matthew says, he saw the multitude, so he goes up to a mountain, right? And then his disciples came, and he opened up, and he started teaching. From what I read, some other places said it might have been in a plain and not on a mountain. Was this an actual single-time teaching, or is this actually a compilation of many teachings? Well, the Christian scholars argue that back and forth. Whatever. We are not here to address at this time the historicity of the moment, but rather the source of the teachings. Now, it opens up with a section called the Beatitudes. It opens up with a whole bunch of things here saying blessed be or blessed are, which from what I've been able to ascertain online actually would have been in the original Hebrew a very famous term that most, if not all, Orthodox Jews know, called Ashrei. Happy are. Ashrei Yoshevei Beitecha. Happy are those who dwell in your home. That's the famous opening verse that we recite before Psalm 145 when we recite the prayer, Psalm 145, in prayer three times a day. So everybody knows the word Ashrei, which means happy are. Now, I'm not going to bother going through each one here. It says, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, they're comforted. I actually was snooping around online, and I found an interesting, of all things, a missionary website. That's right, a Christian missionary website of Jews who purport to believe in Christianity. And they went and made a Hebrew version of each of these, in quote, Beatitudes. Here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And he shows actually where this comes from. Psalm 34:18. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And again, they go and show how this comes from Psalms. Psalm 119, this is my comfort, my affliction, that your word gives me life. And on it goes. Judging from the material that I've seen from the other rabbis, from the other books, all of these references here can be found in traditional Jewish literature, references to either Psalms, I believe Flusser in his book makes a correlation to the Thanksgiving scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and if you look at what they're teaching, this is a simple term that those in the Torah circles should know very well. We call it Musar. Musar means moralistic teaching. Now, from what we understand historically, Yeshu is this individual going around, and who is really attracted to him? Apparently, it was mostly the lower economic class. The people who were the most simple and their religious faith. So, even to this very day, people who are simple in their religious faith don't go around, you know, with great examination. They see a rabbi, someone's called a rabbi, they respect them. in spite of the fact that even today we know that many respected rabbis are actual criminals, people, you know, they put those things aside. Nothing new under the sun. So when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs will be the kingdom of heaven. Interesting. Remember this term, Malchuta Dishmaya, kingdom of heaven. Remember how Yeshu originally uses this. It does not say, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs will be a portion in heaven. Because when you say poor in spirit, all right, these are the people who are also poor in money. And if somebody's in poverty, you don't comfort them by saying, oh, you'll have a nice place in heaven. All right? Starve for the rest of your life, live in poverty, when you die, you'll be rich. Gee, thanks. No. But if you could say to people, you know something, the time is coming. The kingdom of Israel will be restored. We're going to get rid of the Romans. All right, there's going to be a war. We're going to get rid of them. And you people who are poor now, you're going to be on top. Because we're going to be able to get rid of those who are holding you down. Sound familiar? Think of Russia, 1917. Think of Vladimir Lenin, right? Overthrowing the bourgeois by the hand of the proletariat. Yeah, I'm talking communism. No, I'm not saying that Yeshu was a communist. Please don't say that. I did not say that, so don't say it in my name. But this is a class struggle. This is rich v. poor. And as such, Yeshu's going right into it and fanning the flames. Blessed are those that mourn, they will be comforted. And like we said, each of these has a source in Psalms and other literature of the time. But still, it's nice, Mosar. In other words, these are moral things. These are things that make people comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Notice it doesn't say you're going to have a nice portion in heaven. They're going to inherit the earth. How is that going to happen? Blessed are those which do hunger and thirst after righteousness. They will be filled. How do you hunger after righteousness? What's righteousness? What greater righteousness in this time period? You read this throughout Josephus. You read this through other works. Greater righteousness than overthrowing the yoke of the Romans. This wasn't just a call for chumrot in Torah, as we would call it today. Stricter observances of the Torah. Well, Yeshu's got his own on that. But this was a call that the people understood. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Interesting juxtaposition. Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. Wow. Blessed are the peacemakers. They are called the children of God. Wait a second, didn't I just say, am I not implying that this is a call for war? So what's all this peacemaking talk? Well, bottom line, when in ancient Israel they called for peace, how did peace come about? Peace came about like with the, whatchamacallit, the Maccabees, right? You overthrow the enemy. The fact that he's referring to peacemakers, that's kind of like, if you remember in Ronald Reagan talk, he referred to what, some of the intercontinental ballistic missiles, he called it the peacemaker? Yeah, I guess that'll make peace all right. I think that's how you have to understand this context in the greater scheme of things. So, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Who are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake? Well, do you remember the old, well, obviously everybody knows, it says that Yeshu was put on a cross. Well, a cross, crucifixion, was the traditional form of Roman execution for sedition against the government. Treason, troublemakers, terrorists. Jews were crucified by the thousands. And it went on for a long time. During the days of the Seleucid Greeks, Jews were murdered in large numbers. All, like it says here, for the sake of righteousness. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Why? Because when the kingdom of heaven comes and that the enemy is overthrown, you then will have your revenge. Remember, notice there's no necessary reference to the afterlife or mention of heaven. No, not at all. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manners of evil against you falsely. There are three words here in the text that I intentionally left out. If you read the book of Isaiah chapter 53, big argument. Well, the Christians want to say that refers to Yeshua. Now, you even have certain Jewish sources like the Zohar, which says it does speak about the Messiah. And then you have others who say, like Isaiah himself, that it refers to collective Israel, because it says, Israel is my servant, right there in Isaiah. Read it. But how to interpret a scripture verse is really irrelevant. The concept of the suffering servant, clearly, by Isaiah's words, refers to the entire nation of Israel. And if indeed the Messiah is a member of the nation, which obviously he is, he's the king of the nation, then he's going to suffer right along with the people. And therefore the Messiah is going to suffer just as the people suffer. And so Isaiah 53 speaks equally about Israel and its Messiah. You'll find that in the Talmud, you'll find it in the Zohar. Don't bother arguing about it. It's ridiculous. But the point is, we who stand up for what is righteous are reviled. We who stand up for what is righteous are persecuted. Now, look throughout the history. Like I mentioned earlier, who are the ones throughout the centuries who have always been reviled and persecuted? Not Christians, Jews. Because they stand up for righteousness. Now, here in this verse it says, blessed are you if and when you are reviled for my sake. I'm not really sure Yeshua said those three words, for my sake. Because according to these teachings, this is right at the beginning of his public work, his public mission. As such, I don't think anybody was really at that time ready to lay down their lives for him. This is the time he's getting to know you kind of stuff. So in that respect, I question those three words. But yet, the concept of Jewish suffering is very well known. I made a comment in writing on Mel Gibson's anti-Semitic film about Yeshua, where in which they showed Yeshua's horrific suffering. And I made a comment and I said that when I saw the suffering of Yeshua, no, I did not think of Yeshua individually, because I'm not so sure he really suffered crucifixion at all. I'm more of the Hugh Schoenfeld school that I really think that was a hoax. You'll find that the Quran says the same thing, but that's not for now. And yet, when I saw, in quote, the portrayal of Yeshua's suffering, I thought of all those countless thousands of unnamed Jews who also suffered just like that, at the hands of Romans, and later at the hands of Christians. And that's something that Christians today really don't like to think about. So I think that's something that really needs to be taken into account. And I know the modern Christian apology or polemic is, well, they weren't real Christians. To which I respond, well, there were no others. Yes, they were. And the hatred and anti-Semitism continues to this day in very many a church. I have seen in recent writings, even when they were referencing this ridiculous lie about Rav Kadori, that supposedly knew the name of Yeshua. Now, I investigated that story personally and I discovered it to be completely false, but that's besides the point. In one of the articles referring to the book, they asked the question, how could Rav Kadori, who is a Jew, an enemy of the risen Christ, be called to testify for him? And I saw the subtle Jew hatred in this author's works in a very popular evangelical source there on the internet. Just referring to all Jews as the enemies of the risen Savior. Oh, I'm quoting the Christian Bible. Yeah, I get that. But what does that say about what your beliefs are? This is why, when Yeshua was referring to here, who is he talking to? Obviously the Christians, right? Wrong! When Yeshua said these words, how many Christians were alive on planet Earth? Zero! How many Jews? Many. When he says, when men revile you and persecute you, he is talking to his fellow Jews. And that is what you must always remember. These words were said from one Jew to other Jews. No mention of Christians are here. I'll just throw in a little caveat here before we go on. You'll read later on in verse 47 and later in the story. I'm pretty sure that the Christian scriptures are clear that Yeshua himself was rather racist and anti-Gentile in equal proportion today as many Christians are anti-Jewish. What do you think of that? I once saw a joke on the internet, which actually I thought was rather funny. It said that Yeshu comes back and he sees the gathering of all the Christians. And he looks out and he says in Hebrew, "Oy vey, what are all these goyim doing here?" Goyim means the nations or non-Jews. And it's traditionally used as a derogatory term for Christians, even though it's not really derogatory. And the point was, the historical Yeshu, again, like I write in our opening, is, was, lived, whatever, Jewish. There was no Christians here. None. What we're reading here, where is Christianity in here? There is nothing here which we do not find a foundation for in Tehillim, Psalms, maybe Dead Sea Scrolls, all Jewish stuff. But yet the Christians look at this and elevate this as their higher morality, not realizing that their higher morality is our Torah. That's the message that we need to teach. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. Now we're talking about the afterlife, not necessarily this world, when you're persecuted. For so persecuted were the prophets who were before you. That's for sure. Prophets always went through a rough time. But people who are persecuted, they can't always, well, especially those who have already died. What promise can you make? Now think about this. If Yeshu is this radical, political, quasi-messiah figure who is in and out of the shadows due to the nature of his work, all right? The people attracted to him, needless to say, are sympathetic to overthrowing the Roman authority and therefore are suspect in Roman eyes, whose family members most likely are like them, many of whom might have already been caught and killed. So, using the old term, Yeshu is speaking to the choir. He's speaking to people who know what it means to have been spit on by a Roman centurion. He knows what it means. They knew what it meant to be trotted on because they're the simple religious. Do you ever see the simple religious? You go to Israel today and you see the simple religious. The people who are just your simple every day, they work in the factories or this job or that. They're not the college educated, but they're raised in religion. They're faithful to God. They're the good, decent salt of the earth. Gee, that's exactly what Yeshu goes and calls them too. He says, "You are the salt of the earth." But here's more Musar. If the salt loses its savior, then wherefore shall it be salted? And therefore it's good for nothing but to be cast down, be trodden on the foot of men. In other words, if you are to be the innocent and decent and good, what happens when you lose that innocence, decency, and goodness? Well, what good are you? You're trampled on. He's signifying here that the reason why the Roman occupation, otherwise referred to as trodden on the foot of men, it's because of the people's lack of proper righteousness and devotion and sincerity before God. Again, a Jewish message that you'll see echoed and written in countless Jewish books over centuries. Continuing, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and they give light unto all in the house. Let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works." Good works. I thought Christianity wasn't about works. I thought it was about faith. I guess I'm confused, right? Yeah. and glorify your Father who's in heaven. Okay, what is this light? Gee whiz, kind of reminds me of Isaiah chapter 41, I think it was, where Isaiah the prophet says, you are the light to the nations. Don't hide it. Remember, in this Second Temple period, going back to the period before the Maccabees, when the Greeks came in the days after Alexander, they used to go out and work out naked in the big gymnasiums. And the Greeks were like really disgusted by circumcision. So a lot of people tried to hide the circumcision. A lot of people were trying to hide their culture, their origins. They were assimilating. We know that problem today, don't we? So, referring to Isaiah being a light to the nations. What is this light? The gospel. What's the gospel? There was no gospel. At this time, the only light that was there is the same light that we Jews hold to this day called Torah. So you are the light to the world. Who? Christians? There were no Christians. He's talking to Jews. And the only light that Jews had was Torah. This is the historical fact. You cannot deny that. The Torah is what he's talking about then. It's what we talk about now. The Torah is the light to the world. The children of Israel are a light to the world. And he's saying, go out and be proud of who you are. Be proud of your culture. Be proud of what it is to be a Jew. Now, let me reemphasize. Being a Jew in a Torah culture is not the same thing and should never be identified with Eastern European ethnicity, which is predominant in the ultra-Orthodox communities today. You don't have to wear a black hat and speak Yiddish and go oi, oi, oi and eat bagels and lox to be religious. That's ridiculous. That is a cultural, environmental expression which has absolutely no connection to true, sincere religion, period. Make sure that's understood. When it comes to expressing our true Torah path and obligation, like Yeshu said, shine your light so they may see your good works, good deeds. What we always refer to as ma'asim tovim, good deeds. In the 16th century, Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote, midot kadmon lamitzvot. Proper moral character is a prerequisite for the observance of the commandments. You cannot do good works unless you have goodness within you. This goes back to a famous teaching of Rabbi Eliezer in the second chapter of Perkei Avot, where in which it says, what is the best thing in the world? He says, a good heart. A good heart leads to all things. This is one of the famous students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So, doing your good works, that's good moralistic teaching, what we'd call in Torah good musar. Remember, no Christians attended the Sermon of the Mount. They were all Jews. I'm not even sure if there were any non-Jews around. Remember, this was the salt of the earth, the common everyday people, the people who were sympathetic to an expression against the Romans. Most likely they were somewhat sympathetic to an anti-Gentile sentiment, as was Yeshu. So if Gentiles wanted to pop up and come in, I don't think they would have been welcome. I think they might have experienced a similar type of animosity and persecution that Jews today feel many a time from Christians. Try going to a Christian gathering for something as a Jew, especially if you're identifiable as a Jew, and you'll find problems. God forbid, often, sometimes even violence. Moving right along. Here is the, in my opinion, one of the most important teachings that I cannot see how Christians get this wrong. Listen to, this is the famous thing wherein which Christianity claims that Yeshu abolished the Torah, meaning we don't observe mitzvot anymore. But yet, his words are, think not that I have come to destroy the law and the prophets. I have not come to destroy, but to, my translation, King James Version, says fulfill. I've seen other translations say uphold. Forgive me, I'm not a Greek scholar that I can distinguish. For verily I say to you, Yeshki says, till heaven and earth pass, heaven and earth pass. Has that happened yet? Oh, gee, I think we're still on the earth. No? I don't, you know me, what do I know? But I think I'm on earth. I think the heavens and the earth are still here. Not one, the translation is jot or tittle, which should be a yud, all right? Not a smallest letter of the Torah. Not even a, a cantillation mark of the Torah. Shall in no wise pass from the Torah till all be fulfilled. Aha! What does that mean? When Yeshua rose from his crucifixion, that means everything was fulfilled, and now the Torah is no more. That's what Christians say. But I scratch my head and say, wait a second, what happened to the heaven and the earth passing? What happened to all those prophecies like in the end of Isaiah and Ezekiel, remember Gog and Magog and Zechariah? Oh, that's the second coming. Yeah, but isn't that part of the all? They haven't been fulfilled. And if they haven't been fulfilled, then even Yeshua himself is saying to you, don't think that you can get around observing Torah and Mitzvot. I mean, that's the way it looks to me. Whoever therefore shall break one of the least commandments and teach men to do so, he will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Well, if this is not an echo of Pirkei Avot, I don't know what is. Where in which the sayings of our fathers say, never try to judge a minor commandment as opposed to a great commandment. Even in the Kabbalistic traditions, we're taught all commandments are equal before God. Apparently, Yeshua's on the same page. Don't go around trying to think of a mitzvah kala as opposed to a mitzvah hamura. They're all from God, they're all from His Torah, and they're all to be equally observed. Now, listen to this. For I say to you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, shall no case enter the kingdom of heaven. Is this kingdom of heaven, again, a reference to the afterlife? Or the reconstituted kingdom here on earth? I'll let that one be argued, because you already know what my persuasion is. But here he's saying to you, oh, these evil, rotten, disgusting scribes and Pharisees, they're all a bunch of whitewashed tombs, and you don't have to observe the commandments, and you don't have to observe Torah. Yeah, go on, have a pork sandwich on Yom Kippur, and go on, smoke some cigarettes on Shabbat. Right? Just be righteous. Wait a second, what is righteousness? Didn't he talk about making my works, my good works? Who defines good works? Torah. Commandments. No, I'm not going to eat a pork sandwich. Not on Yom Kippur, not any other time. Why does God said not to eat pork? Done. Don't argue. That's it. I don't smoke. Bad for my health. Torah says I have to guard my health. I don't violate the Sabbath. I observe the commandments because that is the right thing to do. And by Yeshua's referring or referencing here to the Pharisees, Perushim, the sages, he is being what we would call in Hebrew, a term which many in the community and Orthodoxy know today, call machmir. Machmir means a stricter application and interpretation. It would be kind of like me saying to you, if you guys really want to live to see Mashiach, he's coming. When? I'm going to tell you right now, Mashiach is... I'm giving this only as an example, so please don't misquote me. For example, I will tell you, Mashiach is going to be here in the next 24 months. Now remember, that's only an example, so don't quote me, that's any legitimate. I've got to be very careful, because you know how people are. And if you want to live through the next 24 months, then you better be more strict. You better make Lubavitchers, the Breslauers, and even Satmar look irreligious compared to how strict you have to be. Now, if you're a new Torah in an Orthodox community, you're familiar with who Breslovers are, and Lubavitchers, and Satmar. You know, they're very strict Hasidic communities. And if I was to say to you, well, if you want to live to see Mashiach come, you've got to be stricter than that. Well, you would understand that within a modern context of rigidity and chumrot, as we call them in Hebrew, in observation of law. You would all of a sudden become very strict. I've got to be very religious. I've got to be very strict. I'm not going to take any more leniencies or this and that. Apparently, this is Yeshua's attitude. So therefore, he does not come to destroy. He does not come to overthrow. Rather, he says, I'm here to establish this. I'm not here to teach you something different. I'm not a reform or a conservative like modern times. No. I believe, and again, in the most strictest form of Qumrot. Now, today, by Torah observance standards, we do not observe all the stricter interpretations. Those who want to do it, they have permission to do so. They consider themselves to be of a higher standing and sometimes hypocritically think themselves superior, but that's another story for another time. But Yeshu's message here about observing Torah being strict in observance, remember, this is not said to Christians. There are no Christians here. He is telling his fellow Jews, you have to be strictly, meticulously observant of the laws. Now, you can challenge me and say, well, there are other times in later in the script, in the Christian Bible here, wherein which Yeshu seems to violate the law. And I'll say, well, you want to know something? Violating the law in this period of time is subject to discussion. Why? Because the laws that we observe today were codified in the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in about 170 of the Common Era, a good 150 years, ballpark, after this time. So what was the halakha during the time of the Second Temple? That is what you have to ask. And put Yeshu's actions and behaviors in that context. He was still being an extremely, what by modern standards would be, right wing extremist ultra-Orthodox. For those of you who are familiar with modern concept, think, if you will, of groups like the Naturi Karta, the extreme in Mea Shearim. Well, that's all culturally Eastern European, but aside from that, for those of you who are familiar with Yerushalayim, you can go north of Mea Shearim, north of Beit Yisrael, and into, say, the Shechunat Bukharim, where you'll get into the Haredi, ultra-Haredi world of the old Sfaradim. This is the old community of Hachamusafi and the rest. Those are the old Baghdadi Sfaradim. I'll bet you that if Yeshu could have taken a time machine and traveled, he would have felt very, very much at home, because their Babylonian culture in that neighborhood was very similar to how it was in Yeshu's day. Not that much dissimilar. And Yeshu probably would have felt very home with that type of extremist Torah mentality, because that's the kind of guy he was. We see it in his words. Again, my emphasis. You want to put these up on lofty pillars, fine. But this is Judaism that's being discussed here, not Christianity. There was no Christianity, and there is no Christianity. So going back to Rabbi Friedlander's comments, when he spoke about the Christian scholars and apologists trying to demonstrate the superiority of their Christian teachings, I scratch my head and I say, my dear Christian neighbor, I'm sorry, these aren't Christian. They're Jewish. And when you understand them within their original Jewish context, that's the same thing we've always taught. You'll probably get a big huh out of a Christian neighbor, because they just have never been shown this. Moving right along. Listen to this. You have heard that it was said by them of old time. Right? Of old time. Whatever that means. I'm not going to get into that. Thou shalt not kill. That's the law. Well, if you're under grace and not under law, I guess that means what? I can kill?
Oh, no, that's not what I meant.
Okay, well, let's see what it does mean. So, thou shalt not kill. And whoever kills shall be in danger of judgment. What does that mean? Well, if you remember, capital punishment is inscribed by the Bible as the penalty for murder. But now listen to what Yeshu says. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause, without a cause. What happens if you do have a cause? Think about that caveat. Shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever shall say to his brother, Raka, Reka, which means empty one. That's like a real curse word. He shall be in danger of the council. In other words, being fined. But whoever shall say, you fool, the danger of hellfire. Two things here. He's telling the people, we know this, we all know this from a Jewish point of view, the Chafetz Chaim. Don't speak Lashon Hara. Don't call people names. Don't insult. That's a Jewish teaching. But wait a second. Whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of judgment. Now, under biblical law, thou shalt not kill. Remember, if a person murders under the appropriate judicial circumstances, he is liable to the death penalty. Is Yeshu saying here that anger is the legal equivalent to murder? In other words, if you get angry, I can get two witnesses, testify that you are angry, and therefore condemn you to death under the court of law? Gee, I certainly hope not. Boy, oh boy, that's a real chumrah. I don't know if anybody would be saved from the court. No. He's not elevating anger to the level of murder jurors from the point of judicially. He's speaking like any other rabbi would about this evil of anger. Musar. This is the same kind of stuff you would read in modern rabbis, the Chafetz Chaim. You would read about this in all the great Torah literature throughout the centuries. You don't call people names. Anger is bad. And there is punishment. Notice here he speaks of danger of hellfire and all the rest. That seems to be like an afterlife thing. Again, I'd have to re-see the original language, which doesn't exist, to see exactly what he meant. But now, moving right along with Musar. If you bring a gift to the altar, that's not some symbolic thing of offering donations in your local church. That was going to the synagogue, that was going to the temple in Jerusalem to offer an animal sacrifice, which was the common observance in those days. And it says, there you remember that your brother has something against you. Leave there your gift at the altar. Go thy way. First be reconciled with your brother and then come to offer your gift. Notice this is a gift altar, not an obligation, right? This wouldn't be a chatat, which is a sin offering, but what we'd call a gift offering. Now, what he's saying here is good musar. You want to give a gift, a matanah, to God. You want to show God how righteous you are by giving a matanah to the altar in the temple. And yet, you have an open anger and disagreement with your neighbor. There is conflict. Remember, the rabbis have always divided the commandments in two different sections. The commandments between God and man, and the commandments between man and man. The commandments between God and man, that's offering an altar. Offering and making an offering on the altar. But yet, when you have conflict and fights and animosity and anger, being a stumbling block and all the rest, you're violating many, many different mitzvot. What Yeshu is saying here is that the mitzvot ben adam l'chavero, the commandments between man and man, take precedent over your wanting to observe, something just for God. That's a Musar teaching echoed in all the teachings of the rabbis. There's no contradiction here, or for that matter, anything Christian here at all. All traditional Jewish Musar. Continuing. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're still in the way with him, lest any time the adversary delivers you to the judge and the judge delivers you to the officer and you be cast in prison. Make peace. These are the wise words of the great sage Hillel. Ohev Shalom, Rotev Shalom. Now, is he referring to making peace with the non-Jew? Remember, there were no non-Jews here. He's referring to one Jew with another. He's trying to get all the simple Jewish people to stop bickering and fighting amongst one another and saying, let's join together and be the one big happy family we're supposed to be. The Musar message that, again, you will find echoed in all the writings of all the rabbis throughout all the centuries. Again, nothing Christian here. Verily I say to you, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the utmost farthing. Farthings? They had farthings in the old days? Or in other words, he's saying, if you don't make peace, and you're going to be subject to who? to the officer and cast in prison. The only one who did that were the Romans. So bottom line he's saying is make peace before you end up in trouble. And now he continues along this similar line. You've heard it said in time of old, thou shalt not commit adultery. Again, just because you're under grace instead of under law doesn't mean that you go around and commit adultery. No, no, no. But I say to you, whoever looks on a woman with lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. The penalty for adultery, again, under proper judicial circumstance, was death. You actually put to death. So are you saying to me now, if you look at lust at a woman, and such a look or feeling could be expressed, verified in front of a court, you'd be put to death? No! But he's saying you're guilty in your heart. Is that what the rabbis teach? Pretty much. Pretty much. And that's why we have all kinds of laws and safeguards against what the eye sees separating. Matter of fact, what Yeshu is here doing is fulfilling the very famous wise words of the Torah. Asus siag l'Torah. Make a fence around the Torah. He is implementing a traditional rabbinic expression, making the observances, adding stricter interpretations to them, with the hope and the intent that people will not come to violate the essence. So therefore, if you violate thinking about a woman in your heart, you're certainly not going to violate in person. If you don't get angry at somebody, you're certainly not going to end up murdering them. These are the fences that he's making. Now he says, if your right eye offends you, pluck it out, cast it from you, for it's profitable for you that if one of thy members should perish, not the whole body should be cast into hell. If your right hand offends you, cut it off, cast it from you, for it's profitable that one of your members should perish, not that the whole body should be cast into hell. Well, there's a whole bunch of hell stuff here. I'd love to see what the original language was. It's been said, whoever shall put away... Oh, okay, let's stop here. Now, is he really telling people to self-mutilate themselves? I have actually seen in modern Haredi writings, where in which, especially the arguments over cell phones. I remember seeing something in print recently which made me laugh, that one rabbi came out and said, rather than use one of these smartphones, you should burn your eyes out with iron hot pokers. Or if your hand picks up, you should better chop off your hand. I don't know many people going around burning their eyes out with hot iron pokers or chopping their hands off. This is symbolic language. This is not literal. Again, Yeshu is trying to say how emphatic and important it is that you don't allow yourself to come and violate the principle. Asu siag l'Torah. Make a fence around the Torah. And these are very, very wise words. They've echoed the words of our sages for over 2,000 years. And it's important that we recognize that we don't push things to the wall. That's why our sages made all kinds of rules. They are not the Torah law. They are rabbinic law. They're very wise in an understanding. And in that respect, this is what we know and understand. Now, let's move on. It has been said, whoever shall put away his wife, let her give her a writing of divorce. A get. But Yeshu says, whoever puts away his wife, save for the course of adultery, right? And shall marry another, and whoever shall marry her, that is divorced, commits adultery. Yeshu says the only validation for a get is adultery. All right, my rabbinic peers out there in the audience, how many of you recognize this law? Number one, it is not the law as it observed today. It is certainly not found in the Mishnah, the Code of Jewish Law, but we recognize this law. This was an opinion held by Beit Shammai. This was the opinion of the house of Shammai with regards to adultery. The argument was between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And Apparently, earlier Yeshua seems to be echoing the words of Hillel. Now he's clearly quoting the house of Shammai. So he said, what side is he on? What difference does it make? We recognize this. It makes sense within a context. I know people to this day who consider themselves married even after they're divorced based upon what Yeshua says here. Because that's the word of God. Well, no, it's not the word of God. It's the word of Beit Shammai that Yeshua is quoting. If you're divorced, you're divorced. That's the end of it. Okay? If you are a Jewish individual and you're married in accordance to Jewish law with the chuppah and kiddushin, if you have a get, that's done. If you are non-Jewish, what was that? If you're non-Jewish, you are married under the whatever secular law or religious context of your culture and you were divorced accordingly, you're divorced. That's it. Now, I believe in Catholicism. To this very day, they still don't recognize divorce based upon this principle. But again, Torah does not teach this. So, going back to the superiority of a Christian morality, I would think that the morality of Beit Hillel overrules or outrides the morality of Beit Shammai. But that's just me. Alrighty. I think that we've actually come to the end of our time period today in this class tonight. So we'll continue on this. We're going to continue going through all these words and view them with the grace of God and the eyes and light of Torah. I want to thank you all again for joining me. I'm your host, Ariel Bartzadok. Come see me online at koshertorah.com. Hope to be back with you soon. God bless. Good night. Shalom.